Welcome to my Bob Thurman podcast. I'm so grateful some good friends enabled me to present them to you. If you enjoy them and find them useful, please think of becoming a member of Tibet House US to help preserve Tibetan culture. Tibet House is the Dalai Lama's cultural center in America. All best wishes. Have a great day.
This is episode 165, Dewa, Emptiness, and the Buddha's Inspiration.
Buddha was the greatest scientist who has lived in recent eras in our history. 2,500 years ago, he predicted the infinite divisibility of matter, the inevitability of causal processes. He created a theory of evolution, of biological evolution, that involved the body and the species and the genes and everything, but also the mind, allowing a third set of genes being mental genes, which is something we haven't quite reached yet, but because of the prison of materialism. And based on his physics of voidness and relativity, his biology of causality and genetic inheritance and genetic transformation, and his psychology of understanding the unconscious and how to master the unconscious actually and make it conscious, and based on these three breakthroughs, he also created a magnificent system of medicine for healing people's body and mind, which when I was a young seeker of nirvana, enlightenment, when I first discovered in this life the Buddha's teaching and was drawn to it like with overwhelming attraction and satisfaction, I was forced by my old teacher in my 20s to learn Tibetan medicine, which is the surviving form of Buddhist medicine, very interrelated with Chinese medicine and Ayurveda medicine, which themselves are more connected with their Hindu and Taoist culture, which Chinese Buddhism and Indian Buddhism never tried to interfere with except to make it a little more mild and gentle. But otherwise never, because Buddhism doesn't, being a scientific tradition fundamentally, doesn't interfere with religious traditions, except for those aspects of them that lead people into violence, which is therefore evolutionarily harmful to them. So, but otherwise encourages people to be spiritual and religious in whatever way is appropriate to their culture. So based on that, when His Holiness the Dalai Lama asked me and my family to try to create an institution, a world institution, just starting in America, that would preserve and would promote and expand and sustain Tibetan culture, Tibetan Enlightenment culture or Buddhist culture in the face of communist invasion and self-destruction and destruction of that culture. I didn't know what to do. I felt overwhelmed by that request from my beloved teacher and friend, His Holiness Dalai Lama. But that night I dreamt of a network of healing centers where Tibetan Buddhist medicine, which is the continuation of Indian Buddhist medicine, of Buddha's Buddhist medicine, would be able to deliver services to people who were sick based on the over-consumerist, commercial culture, materialist culture, providing them with bad food, with not such good, and the healing culture, which doesn't really heal very well because it treats them like they're mechanisms and gives them powerful drugs with side effects that people don't know, and then jumps too quickly to surgery, which really was developed to its high degree of skill and sophistication in our culture because of our many wars, patching people over from war, but is not necessarily the first thing to jump to when people have problems in their bodies, which are not caused by violent, injury. So to start that, then that was my vision, and I saw that being of great service to people, in partnership with existing medical industries and systems in different countries, but providing this connection with body and mind, the three humors or the three energy patterns and the three poisons of mind and so forth, the way that Buddhist enlightenment medicine does. And so I was then a very kind woman gave us at Tibet House, which is the institution we founded, they gave us a land in the Catskills near my own home, actually, so manageable by my beloved wife. And where I could also function and teach and so forth and try to inspire people, and called Menla, which we called Menla, thanks to another dear friend, Harriet, who suggested we use the Tibetan word rather than, I was going to call it Baishajya, which is the Indian word for the medicine Buddha. But Menla is the Tibetan one, which is one, just two syllables, and it fits because it comes through Tibet, the whole thing, to the kindness of Tibet. And this is the first, I hope, in a worldwide chain of such institutions, which in countries where Tibetan medicine is not known to be beneficial and therefore is legalized, as in India or China, it can, in a spa sort of setting, serve to help people with their positive health, through meridian-oriented massage, through cupping, through acupuncture, through herbal and dietary things, and physical yogas and things like that could really help people find how to make themselves well and healthy, and not just ordinarily recovered, basically barely from something, but really filled with energy and well-being. And so that is Dewa Spa. That has the Tibetan word for happiness is Dewa, and the great happiness of enlightenment is called Dewa Chembo. And when we first had the spa, again, because of my affinity about Sanskrit, we called Mahasukha Spa, which means great bliss spa. So in a way, enlightenment spa. But then my wife, being better, more intelligent than me, decided also she would go for a two-syllable word, so she called it Dewa Spa, which is the Dewa. It's a very easy, nice word, Dewa, and it means bliss or happiness, and it means ease, Dewa does, and opposite of suffering, and then it means bliss, and as Dewa Chembo, it's the great bliss of enlightenment, So it's really the same word, but it's easier to say. It rolls off the tongue, Dewa Spa. And people have already been coming for some years. It's getting more and more popular. And just, it's not really, we don't present it as medical because we're not medical people. We don't want to get in trouble with the medical thing. We present it as a spa, healing, well-being thing, wellness center. And occasionally, of course, we do have doctors. We have Tibetan Buddhist physicians come there. We invite acupuncturists, we invite people who are actually licensed in this and that way. All our massage therapists are licensed, but they've been retrained by Tibetan physicians of the Tibetan meridian-oriented, like acupressure, spa thing, and yet very pleasant. And we teach people how to massage themselves, actually, even. We have courses like that. And it's a beautiful building. My lovely and beautiful wife, she built it, and she was the contractor to save money. Great people like the Lynn and Mark Benioff gave funds to develop it. And we had a wonderful artist, the great Robkar Wangchuk, and the great Samden Dakpa, two really beautiful and talented, incredibly talented Tibetan artists who painted things. And the Duke Beeson, a wonderful architect who worked really well with the artists to make a wonderful building within our means, which are modest. And so we want to invite everyone to come and enjoy it, and you get the flavor of Tibetan culture, you get the wisdom of Tibetan Buddhist science, and you get the pleasure of a spa in a beautiful country setting in the Catskill Mountains, in a magic valley where Even the valley has magic, which maybe is sort of karmically why the angel woman, who without necessarily being even a Buddhist or realizing it, undoubtedly is a Bodhisattva Tara emanation, who prefers perhaps to be anonymous, so I don't mention name, who gave us this beautiful 325-acre property with these buildings on it, which we adapted and developed, and then we added some. And this place, the valley itself and the mountain behind it, which is called Panther Mountain at the moment, which is kind of auspicious, like Black Panther movie, since that's a very auspicious movie. You know, it has a little flavor of Wakanda, maybe the mountain, let's hope. And but in the future, I think it will be called Menla Panther Mountain, I have no doubt, because I think this will be a very, very famous spa, maybe after my death in another generation. But because people will really feel well, and people do feel well. It was made by a meteorite that slammed into the earth when this was ocean, actually, where the Catskills now are. And it created, dug up this huge valley, and so about 1,000 meters or more underground is a huge magnetic iron meteorite, giant. It was like huge, like the size of the one Bruce Willis destroyed in Armageddon. You know, huge one would have ended life on Earth if it had hit above ground, but it hit underwater, so it just created enormous earthquakes and things and pushed up mountains. But this makes a magnetic thing under the Menla Valley, which is surrounded by natural forest, and people are a little, an ounce or two lighter on a scale, and they feel a buoyancy, and everyone who goes there, and when I teach there, I feel that, and people who study there, they learn something. Their mind makes impressions, and they learn deeper, and they feel deeper things when they meditate, or when they chant and sing, like Krishna Das comes there, and he flips out and has a great time, because it's such a magic valley, as well as a place where this knowledge of Tibetan Buddhist civilization, you know, filtered through Tibetan wisdom and compassion and kindness and skill and art, was delivered to people, offered as a service, you know, without having to subscribe or join or whatever. But of course, they have to support it to keep it going, naturally. So anyway, that's the Dewa Spa. And you're all invited to Menla to enjoy the Dewa Spa and enjoy any of the various teachings and trainings that are given there. I am moved in thinking about Shakyamuni Buddha's life and how he, sitting under the Bodhi tree, before he could attain perfect enlightenment, which he did that next morning, he had to cope with the devil, whose name is Mara in the Indian imagination and the Indian, you know, heaven. And that devil is a very difficult tempter who tried to tempt him with first with lust and then with fear and aggression. And the last temptation was a sort of mental ignorance one, where the devil went to him and said, "Okay, you were not enticed by my daughters doing their dance of seduction. You were not overwhelmed and frightened by my demonic armies who would try to attack you, throwing mountains at you and bombs and whatever. You repelled all of that. But on top of that, how come you're asserting that you're going to be a Buddha? Who asked you to be a Buddha? And by what right do you say, 'I'm going to be a Buddha and save all beings from suffering'? You know, aren't you being arrogant and ridiculous saying that?" So Buddha said, "No." He said, he returned back to the devil and he said, "Well, you are king of the devils, the Maras, because you, at one time when you were living in hell, you had a moment of compassion for one of your fellow devils. And from that moment, you then became that good karma of being somewhat empathetic and compassionate to another's suffering, which you certainly are not manifesting now as a devil. But you, because of that one moment, you rose to be at least the head of the devils." So the devil then said, "Aha, so you are my witness that I had that karma, and therefore it has now given me this fruition. So, but you say you did," so then Buddha said, "I did infinite previous things for other beings. I totally had compassion even when I was in hell to other demonic buffaloes. We were pulling plows through the nervous systems of suffering beings. And I felt sympathetic, and I was killed by a devil herdman. And I did also many other things, gave my body, my life, my wife, my friends, my property, my kingdoms, my everything, my eyeballs, and bloodstream, whatever it was I gave, life after life. So then the devil said, well, you are my witness that I did one good thing. And who on earth can be your witness that you did all those good things that you are saying? So in that response, Buddha said, Earth is my witness. Mother Earth is my witness. And he placed his right hand down with the fingers extended below his knee, touching Mother Earth, showing his connection to the Earth. And then Mother Earth came out of the Earth, actual Prithvi, like Persephone. Prithvi, as they say in Sanskrit, she came up out of the Earth part way, her upper part of her body, and she began to recite the different previous life stories of the Buddha, where he showed his generosity, his ethicality, his compassion, his tolerance, his creativity, and so on, all his meritorious actions. And the devil said, drat, and he went back to his devil heaven and thinking of more ways how he could trip up the Buddha's deeds, thinking, well, he'll become a Buddha, I can't stop him now. But maybe I can trip him up as he develops a teaching and tries to help the beings on the planet. I can prevent him from saving other beings from suffering, which I like to keep them in. So that's how Buddha did it. So Buddha's earth-touching gesture was the beginning, was an initial Earth Day in the Buddha's mission, showing his sense of interconnection to all of life. And then when he attained enlightenment, later that morning, he first remembered infinite previous lives, where he had been every single kind of being on any aspect of the earth and any kind of species and whatever it was, and he remembered all of it and therefore identified with every single form of life, having been one himself, at least once in endless times. And he also then became second, he remembered and became aware of all other beings, how they had lived and died infinitely, and therefore how he had been entangled with all of them, which meant he was completely almost like one life force with all of them. All beings of all species, good, bad, including the devil Mara, anyone. He'd been all of them, and they'd been all of, you know, all forms with him, positive and negative. He realized all of that, and then attained nirvana, bringing all of that with him, actually, because of understanding the illusoriness of time. Even though other beings had not yet reached a form where they could be self-aware, and had the complexity of intelligence that are required to become a perfect Buddha, he realized that they all would, and he realized that he would have the infinite, all-pervading omnipresence to be there to help them do so and make all the right choices, even though he was knowing his connectedness, but also knowing each one's separate independence, that he couldn't force them. They had to do it through their own choice, through their own action. But he would be with them to see that they had the maximum help in making all the best choices throughout all of their lives, whether they're in human form or not, whether they're in the form of a slug or a bacteria. The Buddha is a positive bacteria who helps the other bacteria learn to behave better and magnify their being bit by bit toward Buddhahood. So Earth Day means, therefore, actually, Nina and my youngest son, whose name is Mipham, means invincible, undefeated, a name of Maitreya, the future Buddha, who will come in tens of thousands of years from now, if not hundreds of thousands, which indicates the Buddhist vision of the future, that the planet will not be destroyed. Even the most stupid human culture, such as the materialistic one that we now inhabit, modern materialistic one, which is very, very reckless and destructive of the environment, will not succeed in environing it and destroying it, because its members will awaken in time, are awakening now in time, to realize their interconnection, their indelible and immortal, and in a way, future interconnection, because dying will not make them remove from their connection to life, all life. So they just cannot get away from other species, they cannot get away from the planet, other planets even, but why mess up this one? We will do that. We will master this situation for sure. Love and compassion and intelligence will master the recklessness, stupidity, and ignorance that is currently wrecking the planet. So Buddha is on top of that. It is not just a random sort of mechanically, you know, fate-directed thing by some sort of inscrutable fate or negative fate or, you know, horrible thing called entropy, which is kind of deified by materialists into the devil, into hell sort of thing, the materialist form of hell. It will not succeed. We will defeat it because by our intelligence we have, and we do every day. And Buddha also is millions of Buddhas, not just Shakyamuni, millions of enlightened beings who develop true mastery of mind and therefore of matter are all there helping us all and helping us come around to the right decisions and choices to not destroy ourselves, but to, in fact, exalt ourselves with the realization that we are the earth. We are each other. We are other species. They are us. And we are responsible. Each one of us takes responsibility for all of that. And there will be no destroying of all of that. Even we will die as individuals, of course, but we'll be reborn and we'll continue bit by bit. And those of us who are more generous and more intelligent and more connected and save lives and save Earth and save plants and save people and so forth, we will be reborn ever more strong and more powerful and more vigorous, whereas those who are foolish and ignorant and reckless and who out of short-term greed wreck things in order to gain more profit and more money for themselves and more seeming disconnected power and abusive power over things, they will be reborn after they will die also. Of course, everyone dies and is renewed. They will be renewed weaker and weaker because of behaving like that. So we will inevitably succeed. There's no doubt about it on Earth Day. And as our Mipham son symbolizes for us, our youngest, who was born on Earth Day, April 22nd, that is his birthday. And that was his Mother's Day at the same time. And so everyone must be Mipham also, of course, because future Buddha, actually Vimalakirti, one of my favorite models in life, the critic, the ultimate critic, he even teased Maitreya where he met him in his heaven, said Maitreya lives, or one of Maitreya's visits to Earth. And he said, what's so special about you that you're going to be a Buddha in next life? Because you can't be a Buddha until everybody's a Buddha. So everybody's going to be a Buddha in your next life. So don't single yourself out like that. He gave him this deep, wonderful critique of the most hallowed future loving Buddha that will come in the future of Maitreya, Mipham, Ajita, as his Sanskrit name says, Ajit, you know, still a common name in India, Ajit, meaning invincible or undefeated. So this is great, and don't despair, but vote. And then every day will be Mother's Day, and every day will be Earth Day, and we'll get past all this racism and speciesism and sexism and ridiculous behavior that has been causing the destruction of things on the part of unhappy people who feel disconnected themselves and therefore cannot enjoy themselves, but unfortunately think that by owning and grabbing, they'll become more connected. Whereas by doing that and depriving others, they become more and more disconnected. On the other hand, those who are more connected by empowering others, by seeing to the success of others, and there are business people who are like that. My friend Mark Benioff is one of them. And they show that true wealth comes from empowering others and helping others succeed, which is really the essence of the merchant mentality, actually. This militaristic grab everything from everybody else is actually more like a violent militaristic type of mentality and does not lead to wealth. It leads to destruction and poverty in the longer run, although can result in some short-term grabs like the destruction of the beautiful city of Troy and grabbing all its looting and pillaging at one time, and then it's not there to produce more beauty. That's the problem with the military one. So militarism and consumerism, hatred and greed magnified by the ignorance of nihilistic materialism, this now will be brought to an end. We're reaching a point in the planet very soon. We will have a really, truly great new age. Earth Day will be everywhere, and we'll all really have a great time. I guarantee you. I have assurance. Take care.
This episode of the Bob Thurman Podcast was originally broadcast Earth Day 2018 on Facebook. To watch a video version of part of this podcast, please visit Robert Thurman on Facebook. And to watch classic episodes of the Bob Thurman Podcast, remastered as educational videos, please visit the Tibet House US YouTube channel. Every like, view, comment, and subscription helps support Tibet House and its ongoing mission to present and preserve Tibetan culture. And now back to Bob and the second half of this week's podcast.
Hi, this is Bob Thurman. I want to talk today a little bit about emptiness and relativity. Emptiness, it does not mean nothingness. It's the opposite of nothingness. Nothingness luckily means nothing. And luckily nothing is nothing. And therefore, it cannot entrap anybody. However, there can be an experience of nothing. You can have a pass out, blank out, unconscious experience of unconsciousness in a way. Every time you fall asleep, actually, you have an experience of falling into what seems like a falling into unconsciousness. And this is a very important point because there is a lot of misunderstanding about emptiness. And especially Buddhists who meditate, but also yogis who may be, you know, Shaivite or Vaishnavite or Shakti-oriented, they also becoming yogic adepts. They can have experiences of nothingness. The Buddhist scientists long back, which I believe is more or less shared with the like Yoga Sutra type yogic scientists in India, so very similar really. You know, don't be fooled by the seeming difference between Atma and Anatma, self and non-self, because Buddhists also teach self, you know. And in a way, the neti-neti teaching of the Upanishads is also teaching non-self. So the people wrongly thought these were just two opposite things, but there are some differences. Anyway, they all kind of agree that there are something beyond the four pure form realm or pure matter realm, subtle matter realms, of what are called the Brahma body realms, the divine realms of immeasurable love, immeasurable compassion, immeasurable joy, and immeasurable equanimity. Beyond those four, which are four marvelous ecstatic states, although the equanimity one, the ecstasy has become so widespread that it's not really kind of like a thrilling kind of thing because it's just so even and smooth that bliss is in there, ecstasy is in there, joy is in there, love and compassion are all in there, but it's just all totally universalized. So that's why it's called equanimity. It's equal everywhere, you know. Beyond those four states, there's the four disembodied states, which are called the realms of formlessness. And these are the states of infinite space, infinite consciousness, absolute nothingness, or, you know, nothing whatsoever. Sounds too absolute. So nothing whatsoever-ness. And then beyond consciousness and unconsciousness. Those are four formless realm states where there are many beings that have become deities of the formless realm and who get stuck in those states for a long period of time from Buddhist point of view. Perhaps from some Hindu point of views, they think those are threshold states for ultimate enlightenment in the form of nirvikalpa samadhi or a non-conceptual one-pointed concentration, where in a way the Supreme Self, they think, obliterates all its interconnection with everything, or in a way swallows everything into its one-pointed, spaced-out concentration, something like that. And but the Buddhists consider those four as only relative states, even though all four of them, of course, seem like absolute states. Just imagine you're there in really meditative concentration, and you've already had a huge expansion of your sense of being, like a divine expansion of it, actually, in the Brahma Viharas, the Brahma abodes, as they are called, or the four immeasurables, love, joy, love, compassion, joy, and equanimity. And so you're and the love one is you just feel you're a wave, a river, an ocean of love toward all beings, immeasurably. And then compassion is where you really reach the beings and you feel how they feel. And then you know that they are not feeling love necessarily. And so you then feel compassion to them, which is what means that your love wants to fill up and sort of drive away their sense of suffering and make them feel loved and make them feel blissful and happy, you know. And then you have a joy when that succeeds, and that becomes immeasurable. And you feel it's all joy, and you see them in a way all as joy at some level. Although you may not be seeing this with your total subtle consciousness, it may be still at a level where it's not total for you. And then finally, equanimity, where you're sort of even self and other, there's almost no perception of other as other than self. And you feel all of you as filled with love and compassion and joy and equally, and that's the equanimity state. So you already had vast states. And yet all of those still have a sense of the other being other, and your oneness with them leaves intact their otherness. And so you're still in the different, it's called the form realm, a realm of pure form or pure matter or subtle matter, because although you still perceive the differentiatedness of things, you feel a oneness in spite of that. So you have a kind of cognitive dissonance of the oneness with the differentiation. It's like when you're in love with someone really deeply, and you're with them, and you feel they are you and you are they, but in a way you love that they are them because they're so beautiful and you're so much in love with them. So you're both one with them and you want them to be supremely there, you know. So it's like a kind of more complicated love, true love state, you know, which is not self-centered and not grasping and not possessive. And so, but then there may be a sense of strain in that. And then there definitely is where you kind of sail free from the sense of division between self and other. And you don't see any bodies. Once you're in a bodiless state, there's no differentiation of self and other because there's no bodies, no boundaries. And so everything seems to be infinite space. And then once you're in it's all infinite space, and it's not that you're in it, in a way you are it. You have no sense of a subjectivity boundary. There still is a core, a sort of very subtle subjectivity boundary, but you have no sense of that. So you don't have a body in there. You don't feel that you are, but you are just the infinite space. And you don't feel you left behind any others. You feel they are also there with you. That's their deeper reality. So in a way, you think everything is there. It's a real oneness experience. And a marvelous one, actually, and important to be aware of it. And then your mind, however, automatically, since it doesn't feel it's subjectively different, it sort of explodes out into the space. And then you sort of feel it's all aware. The vast space is not like an objective, dull, inert space. It's a space of awareness, and that's called the infinite consciousness. You know, and it's like explosive, you could say. And then that becomes, because it's exploding to encompass infinity, becomes infinite, and in a way never ends. And also in a way never begins, because it doesn't start from any point in your subjectivity. But then the sort of intensity of it becomes a little tiresome to you, perhaps, because you're looking for ever and ever more deeper states of peacefulness. Is what inclines you toward these formless states, and then you have a state like a darkened state, where everything seems to be nothing, including you, and you don't feel, there might have a feeling of fear way back earlier when you're going to infinite space, but at this point you will not have any kind of fear, and you will go there into this deep kind of unconsciousness and a darkness, as if everything is just this nothingness. And then, if you don't get trapped in that, or any of the... Okay, starting. If you don't get trapped in them, or in any of these sort of formless states, and feeling that this is the end of the supreme, this is it, which naive beings will, and then they'll become a deity, according to the Buddhists. They'll be a deity of the bodiless state, where they'll stay for a really long time and even lose track of their coarse body on an ordinary planetary human form, and that will fall away, you know. Initially, when they go into those kind of states, the body goes into a kind of trance, like a hibernatory trance. But when they, if they really get stuck in one of them by clinging to it, thinking this is the ultimate final goal, then the body will actually just decay and fall away. They'll never return to it. So there is something to fear if you are not prepared not to be trapped in any form of experience. And this is my main point I want to talk about today. Celebrating the oneness of Mother's Day and Earth Day, which is sort of the day I'm talking more or less, almost close. And which is Mother's Day and Earth Day is celebrating connectedness and the tolerance of infinite interconnectedness. So then you go deeper and deeper. The connoisseur who doesn't get stuck in the three previous ones of infinite space, infinite consciousness, and seeming nothing whatsoever, seemingly nothing whatsoever, those three states, the sort of white, red, and white, orange, and dark one, and black state, those three states. Then there is a more subtle state, which is very, almost, it's inconceivable, unimaginable, where you're sort of conscious and you're sort of still resting and unconscious. So you're consciously unconscious or unconsciously conscious. So you're neither exclusively conscious or unconscious, something like that. And really quite a marvelous state in itself. But yet, again, if you get stuck there and think that you've reached the absolute, which you might if you weren't prepared, then you become lost there for a long time, you know, till some sort of momentum brings you back into embodiment in some place you completely don't recognize, because it's like literally maybe millions or thousands of years, several big bangs later, let's say, to connect it a little bit to our modern astrophysics or cosmology, you know. So, key point, Buddha, who was the best scientist about this, I think better than the yogi guys, but they're very close, so it's okay. But anyway, he was the best. He said carefully, these four states are not nirvana. They're not liberation. They're not moksha. They're not the highest state, actually. Not one of them. Even though in the first entering of them, they feel like a release and a greater degree of peacefulness, even obliteration and beyond obliteration even. Sort of obliteratedly unobliterated, you know. Yet none of them are nirvana. He was just very clear about that from a scientific point of view. And if you know that, if you know emptiness, you know that, because in fact, although it seems like they've always been you when you're in them, the greater intelligence of wisdom knows there was a boundary when it wasn't you, so that it's not, can't be an absolute, because you still are a relative process, however quieted your relative process. Your awareness, even your aware while unaware awareness, is still part of a continuum. And emptiness means you know that, because any state that seems even an absolute is empty of itself being an absolute. So it's only a relational thing, and a relational thing cannot be an absolute. Okay? So this is emptiness, where in a way you transcend time as well, in the sense that you always were there. It's a place you discover that you always were in, and it's no longer, it doesn't obstruct all the any other state that you are in. So it's the absolute relativity, you can use